I don't think you and I would be doing this work if we didn't think it was possible to recover. I think it just depends on what recovery looks like for that couple. Is recovery really staying together? If it is, then that's where a lot of accountability, a lot of non-defensiveness, the subtle little ways that you turn away from your partner, whether it's they're talking to you and you pick up your phone, they ask you a question and you don't answer because you're focused in another way. There's all these subtle ways that we shut off that connection. We don't do empty the dishwasher or subtle things where they're making that bid for connection and people turn away. And it's not, we don't want to blame anyway, but it's just, it's such a great practice for people to go like, oh, I turned away in this way and this way and this way this week. And if both people are recognizing it, then both people have the opportunity to go, oh, when I pick up my phone, I'm turning away from you. Or subtle little things that say, hey, you matter to me and I don't want to turn away from you. It's not that you want to, you know, forgive and forget, because I don't actually think anybody would do that or does that. But it's more that place of like finding that sense of peace inside and recognizing like, I can forgive you, but I haven't forgotten. And when I haven't forgotten, it means that if a memory comes up and I need to talk about it, I need my partner to talk about it with me and be willing to, again, own it, acknowledge that it makes sense what I'm feeling, and be open to hearing all the crazy stories.
Hello and welcome to This Complex Life. Today, I have a guest with me from the other side of the world, Andrea Dindinga. And Andrea is, like me, a marriage and family therapist, or we don't have the marriage and family therapist qualification here in Australia. That's exactly quite the same, but LMFT, I'm guessing. So welcome to the podcast, Andrea.
Thank you so much, Marie.
We've been talking, well, it's been a lot in the news, I guess, around affairs and betrayal. And I know I've done a few episodes about it. In fact, one particular interesting one was people having affairs with the AI chatbot. But maybe we won't go there today. But what do you think people misunderstand about betrayal and infidelity?
It's interesting to think about, you know, people who cheat on their partners aren't necessarily bad people. They're not mean, awful people. I think of them as kind of immature, lacking some skills, lacking the ability to communicate what they're experiencing within their life, within their marriage. And whether it's, I'm feeling lonely, or I'm not feeling like we're connecting, I think they're lacking those skills. And so it's super easy just to turn and be like, oh, shiny new object. You're giving me your attention. We're really focusing on each other. And the betrayal happens just like that.
How do you define betrayal, or how does it show up in the couples or the individuals that you work with? Because this is something I've been really grappling with as I dig deeper and I read forums and posts from people. The definitions vary quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, anything from people who are, you know, on OnlyFans sites and, you know, paying for that. I think of that as betrayal, but obviously having, you know, an extramarital, physical and emotional affair feels like betrayal. I think that even the emotional part of an affair is probably what is most damaging, when somebody, you know, really gives their energy and attention. But, you know, somebody engaging with a prostitute, you know, is looking at somebody saying something about how they thought, you know, their partner looking at pornography was a betrayal. And I don't think of it that way, but I do think there's probably a spectrum. But it's whenever you're like turning away from your partner. I was even thinking when your spouse gives you a present and you return it, how hurt and betrayed they actually feel by that. You know, that's a small little bee betrayal. That's not the kind we're talking about. But I think there's all these little ways. I think also people engage in betrayal, you know, with financial infidelity, where they're opening credit cards and, you know, hiding, you know, their spending from their spouse. I think it happens in so many subtle and gigantic ways.
You mentioned earlier a lack of emotional maturity, I think you were alluding to. And that really reminded me of when I unpack this with some couples, it's often when one person brings up their concern, how the other responds, that's where the extra pain starts. of you're spending a lot of time with person X. And instead of them turning around and saying, yeah, you're right, I haven't actually spent much time with you, and see that as a bid for connection, or their partner makes a comment like, oh, you're always out with so-and-so. And instead of them saying, yeah, I am, or sounds like you want to hang out, you know, the defensiveness comes, the, oh, but you X, but you this, and then how they talk about that in its early days before it's even a big issue seems to be the cause of more of the pain. And then terms like manipulation and gaslighting and all these things get thrown in, when I think it's people feeling, yeah, misattuned, not heard, invalidated, the partner getting defensive, which then when they do find out it's an affair is even more like it shakes their ability to trust themselves.
I know.
Do you see this show up for your, in your work?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the thing I really try and work with my couples around is really that defensiveness, taking accountability for, you know, what they've done, whether or not they meant to hurt the other person or not, just really being able to say, like, it hurt you when I bought the wrong kind of chicken. You know, clearly I didn't mean to, but it hurt you because you're stressed about this dinner party. And helping people to own their actions, own their behaviors. Oh, I was late, and me being late caused you to stress, and that hurt you. And I acknowledge that, and I apologize for that. Really just owning it in that really very specific, clear way, and helping them feel like nobody's going to die if you are imperfect. Nobody's going to die if you've done something that's hurt your spouse. But where it's really damaging is when you start attacking your spouse back for the way that you've hurt them. It feels, you know, it feels so counterproductive.
One of the struggles that I see people have in this, and if I could tell, like, get a megaphone and shout it out, is it doesn't matter necessarily what your intention was. You're not saying that, I agree, I did this to hurt you. It's acknowledging this hurt you. You might have had a great reason. You might have stopped to do CPR on someone on your way home. That's, all of those reasons are fair and valid and fine. And it's still okay to say, it makes sense that you're upset. I was running late and we had plans. That's
I
it.
Think that phrase, it makes sense that you are whatever the feeling is. I think that one phrase, if everybody could memorize that phrase and their partner gets frustrated about anything, it makes sense that you're frustrated about X, Y, and Z. I think it's because then that makes the person feel validated and seen and not crazy.
Yeah. And then for the other person, one of the phrases I get them to say, and I'm pretty sure I borrowed this off Brené Brown, is the story I'm telling myself is.
Oh, yeah.
So then being able to say, when you're late, the story I'm telling myself is, I'm not important to you. And then, you know, have that dialogue. There used to be, I think it's gone in waves. Now, I'm not old enough to have got a very historical, accurate kind of depiction of affairs and people staying together. It feels like there was a time where people just had to suck it up, mostly women. They didn't have the financial means to leave if their spouse cheated. Or maybe in some circles it was even frowned upon to care. It was just sort of like, you just have to suck it up. That's the way things are. And then in some ways it flipped where it's like, leave, you can. And now I'm seeing people feel judged for staying and feel judged for leaving. And I'm not sure how to navigate some of this, but is it possible when people have a betrayal or an infidelity? And I'm thinking more around sort of sexual romantic rather than betrayal of finances, which I guess has similar ways of healing. Is it possible to recover from that?
I don't think you and I would be doing this work if we didn't think it was possible to recover. I think it just depends on what recovery looks like for that couple. Is recovery really staying together? If it is, then that's where a lot of accountability, a lot of non-defensiveness, like a lot of spaciousness around somebody washing the dishes and having that twinge of memory or feeling and being able to say, I was just thinking about how last year at this time you lied to me. And for the spouse that wants to stay in this marriage to be like, that was a year ago. Thank you so much for bringing it up. It's such a hurtful memory. And not to be like, am I never going to be, you know, is it never enough? Like, can I ever be forgiven? I thought we were past this. Like, that prolongs the hurt unnecessarily, but it's such a hard thing to teach. And it's such a hard thing to practice for people just to go like, yeah, that really hurt you. Even though that may have been 10 years ago, that really hurt you. And I feel terrible about it still to this day. I was thinking about it myself, right? And just that kind of coaching people to own their behavior without getting defensive, I think that's where the healing is possible.
Yeah, I think that's a really important piece there, because when the training I've done talks about betrayal as having, for the betrayed spouse, a lot of symptoms that mirror PTSD. And so you'll get the flashbacks, you'll get the triggers, and it could be when a phone rings or you see your partner put their phone in, take it with them to the bathroom instead of leaving it on the table. There might be all these subtle things that are really meaningless in that moment, but they weren't at some point in your history, or you're looking now for, you're hypervigilant and looking on the lookout for those. How the other person responds is really important. It's almost that dismissiveness is invalidating. Mm-hmm. And then I get it for the other person. They're like, oh my gosh, we've talked this to death. When will I be let off the hook? Isn't this over yet? You should be over it by now. You know I didn't mean. And I worry that when that defensiveness gets evoked, they might revert to old coping habits and coping strategies to deal with the discomfort and frustration of shame even. And so, does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's where that piece of emotional maturity comes in. And, for the person who's betrayed their partner to really look at, like, what was going on for me, right? Was I drinking a whole bunch? Was I stressed? Was I not taking care of myself? Was I kind of like, was this a signal that I needed some help? Like, what was that? So often I'll hear, especially a man, say, well, we just weren't having enough. We weren't even having sex, or we weren't having enough sex. And so then I always say, like, okay, well, that may be factually true, but then let's dig into, like, what was underneath that? What kind of emotional connection was being nurtured? And how can we nurture that emotional connection so that the libidinal connection can be alive and robust and desirable? And so then it's like, I think people begin to understand that, like, oh, there was other things that were happening. So why was I turning away? When did I notice I first started to turn away? I think all of that kind of investigation and inquiry work is really part of that person's emotional maturity, so that, 2 years later when their spouse brings it up again, they have the ability to say, like, whoa, it's really hard for me to hear. I'm like sad that you're thinking about this still, and I get it. It was such a terribly painful time, right? Like, all of that. They can still have their feelings, but they can only do that if they've been doing some of their own emotional work to really understand what was happening inside for them.
Mm. It's so powerful. I think I would almost cry if I witnessed a conversation like that, like the raw honesty, pain, but also what a beautiful chance for connection that you can know, this person hurt me, I have forgiven them, and when things arise that's still painful, they can be my greatest comfort too.
Mm-hmm. And they're actually probably the only one who can fully comfort their spouse, right? Their friend, their kid, their mother, their neighbor, can be like, oh, I understand. But they can't be the reassurance or the truth sayer, or, they can't be the one to say, like, they might be like, well, maybe he's cheating again, or maybe she's cheating again, where the person who was the cheater, I hate that word, but cheater, their ability to really own their side of things today, next week, next year, 5 years, I think they're the primary person who can soothe and restore that trust that they've broken.
Hmm. The phrase, the turning away, I think really captures this well, because when I've looked at things like pornography or people exploring, swingers party, there are certain activities that for some people might seem like a betrayal, but coming back to this, is it turning away or towards? So if it's something we're doing together and it ignites us and brings us pleasure and joy and fun, it's not turning away. And so I really like that as a kind of way to distill the boundary that's been crossed there. Is it moving away from an avoidance, a disclosing to someone else. And this is where the emotional affairs I see as being really painful, because you're then telling someone else outside your relationship all of these things that your partner, maybe you haven't even spoke to them about. Or some people think they've spoken to their partner about it, but they've only said it as a complaint or a criticism, not as a, hey, this is actually not going so well. And so you're starting to, it's the turning away, moving away, avoiding of something. Is that how you kind of meant that phrase? Is that
Yeah. And I like to give homework to my couples for a week. Pay attention to the subtle little ways that you turn away from your partner. Whether it's they're talking to you and you pick up your phone, they ask you a question and you don't answer because you're focused in another way. You come home late, or they ask you, like, there's all these subtle ways that we shut off that connection. We don't do empty the dishwasher, or, you know, subtle things where they're making that way, that bid for connection, and people turn away. And it's not, we don't want to blame in any way, but it's such a great practice for people to go like, oh, I turned away in this way and this way and this way this week. And if both people are recognizing it, then both people have the opportunity to go, oh, when I pick up my phone, I'm turning away from you. I'm still going to probably do that because we're addicted to these things. However, I'm going to put it in the drawer when we're in the kitchen together, or just come subtle little things that say, hey, you matter to me and I don't want to turn away from you.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing that we really want, isn't it? Like, I'm thinking about, I do family therapy as well. And most of the time, that's the key thing, is people want to know, do I matter to you? Do I matter? And that's the biggest betrayal there, is if you can do that to me, then I don't matter. And what does that say about me?
What does that say about our family?
Yeah. Or what I've sacrificed, what I've given up, what accommodations I've made, compromises, my worth. One of the phrases I hear people say is, if I forgive them too soon, it's like I've let them off the hook, and then they think they can do this again. And this is the only, you know, punishment they have is a few therapy sessions. So how do you work through that, I guess, difficulty for people, for the hurt partner who might want to salvage things but thinks, if it's too soon, they've gotten away with it. They've done this awful thing and there's been no impact to their life.
I think that goes back to that place of being able to set up an agreement between both spouses that if, you know, 6 years from now, it comes up for me and I need to speak about it, or, you know, 6 months from now, I try and help people recognize that that feeling of anger and hurt and betrayal and just that rage that lives inside of them is actually not good for their nervous system. And so it's not that you want to, you know, forgive and forget, because I don't actually think anybody would do that or does that. But it's more that place of like finding that sense of peace inside and recognizing, like, I can forgive you, but I haven't forgotten. And when I haven't forgotten, it means that if a memory comes up and I need to talk about it, I need my partner to talk about it with me and be willing to, again, own it, acknowledge that it makes sense what I'm feeling, and be open to hearing, you know, all the crazy stories. Oh, I pieced this one thing together and I think you didn't tell me about this. And that kind of place of like, oh, I thought we got over all of this, and that acknowledgement that you're right, I didn't disclose that piece and I'm so sad that it's coming out now and it's re-hurting you again. And it's a, you know, it's, I would love to hear your thoughts on like, how much do you disclose? Like, how much transparency and, you know, how many details do you find that it is, you know, helpful for the spouses to share?
I think it's varied. I think each case is quite unique in that. And I wouldn't want explicit details about any sort of sexual acts, but maybe locations or work trips that weren't work trips, those sorts of things, because going through enough with the partner, I mean, I use the Gottman Attune Attach model, And so mm-hmm. in that atonement phase, it is answering as many of those questions. And if I'm sensing that it's particularly difficult, I might do another individual session with each person, one for the betrayed partner to maybe get their thoughts down in a way that feels containing for them. Because if they get too dysregulated in the session, we can calm it down, but we might not lose valuable time. That's not the right word, but we might have a more fruitful conversation if some of that work can go in behind the scenes. And then also mm-hmm. some work with the other partner to improve their tolerance to sitting in that space. So to try not mm-hmm. to get too activated, to sit in that discomfort a little bit. So it is a bit of a dance. So I'd be trying to find enough information that I don't actually think the person wants all the information all the time. I think they just want to know that there's nothing else you haven't told me that I'm not going to be made right. a fool of, rather than wanting to know the minutiae. The question I had that was coming up for me is, you know, for the partner that has done the betraying, if they've been turning away, that can sometimes come because the relationship satisfaction is low. How do they find enough satisfaction in the relationship to sit there through all that atoning when they weren't happy in the relationship to begin with? They had one foot out. They were seeking that support from another person. How do we get enough? Because the tricky thing is it requires a lot of dedication and work to sit mm-hmm. there in that discomfort, to own the pain, to navigate feelings of shame that might come up.
Mm-hmm.
And often in a situation where maybe for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, your relationship hasn't been great. So how do they find the resource to work that hard, to salvage something that they can't remember feeling that fondly about in recent memory?
I mean, a lot don't, right? A lot just go their separate ways. I think it's the people who do want to make it work, even though they've had one foot out and their head turned and are super disconnected. I think the thing that happens when people are having, you know, an infidelity, there's so much energy. There's just so much energy within that couple. This person is, you know, taking this energy outside of the marriage, and there's a lot of contact. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of adrenaline. There's a lot of dopamine. There's, you know, there's just a lot of that intensity that's coming up. And what I try and help people do is like really connect around what has happened and notice how they actually feel closer, right? There's an exchange of, you know, there's kind of a little bit of oxytocin that's exchanged in that connection that they, when they're able to really be present, and that's that feeling that, you know, that feels really good. And so I think it's that place of like, it feels awful and feelings aren't going to kill us. And if we can be here with them, they actually have the ability to transform and create a really deep and satisfying connection.
How do we help people navigate knowing that one person can't meet all your needs? So you can spread out what you need to different people, but that not be an affair. So I'm thinking enriching friendships, trusting, nurturing conversations. You might want to have your first draft of something with a kind of confidant. And I've worked with some couples where a female has significant sexual abuse history, and they've agreed that it's okay for the male partner to use sex workers. And that has been agreed to, hasn't been seen as a turning away from. It's been a mm-hmm. completely consented, budgeted for sort of thing, just like someone else might need to get a massage or have something. So how do mm-hmm. we find this balance of adjusting our expectations, but not with a sense of selfishness and entitlement, but creating a richer network around a couple? It's probably a big question.
I mean, to me, it just all boils down to that kind of communication, that kind of validation, that sense of safety, that, you know, to be able to talk about one's sexual abuse with their spouse and to recognize that it is causing a significant amount of distress and trauma for them to engage and to have sex, and that this is a, you know, it's a mutually agreed upon system. I've had a couple of couples who have started off with that agreement, and I guess it's been three couples I've had that, and not one of them has made it through. They're no longer married. And I think it's, you know, the at least in the ones I know about personally, it's been this like, well, I'm never going to have sex with you, so you might as well just take care of yourself. But there was never an agreement that we were going to get divorced. But just almost the dismissiveness of that was, I think that's what was so hurtful to the partner who then did go and seek, you know, sexual relationships outside of the marriage. So I think it's so subtle, and it's in that tone and how you communicate and how both people are holding it really intimately and very, very tenderly.
As we sort of wrap, I mean, I could talk about this for hours. I've sort of been doing a deep dive on affairs and infidelity because it, when I was a baby therapist, it was very much right or wrong. You cheated, that's it, you're out. And that's how I would have approached everything. And then doing my couples therapy training and reading a bit more about and hearing the nuance, I have so much more understanding of the complexity. If people are listening and they're wanting to learn a bit more, maybe they're curious or they're trying to navigate some of this for themselves, do you have any good DIY books or podcasts, anything that they can sort of start absorbing if they're not quite ready for therapy yet?
I mean, I love Esther Perel's book, Mating in Captivity. I think the one piece about this book is that, you know, infidelity is as old as time. Like it's something that's happened, you know, for millennia. And so I think that one fact helps you understand that this is maybe part of our relational dynamics, like in our genetics in some ways. And so I think it kind of normalizes it in such a, it just felt really generous, such a generous way of normalizing it. And I think it helps couples, that book in itself helps couples really kind of navigate through some of these dynamics. And I really, really love that book.
Are you thinking The State of Affairs?
Oh, yeah, maybe it is The State
Although,
of Affairs.
Read both. They're excellent.
Yeah, they're both excellent books. And then I think that there's a lot of benefits that come with sitting down with a therapist and having that conversation and getting support where you're like, you know, if somebody is like, I'm really flirting with a coworker, maybe I should actually talk to somebody and get some support around this. So then I could potentially talk to my spouse about what's going on inside. I don't know. I think those are the kind of main things that I think about.
I love those two books. They definitely have helped shape my language around working with infidelity. And if it's around purely sexual needs and gratification, I would say Emily Nagoski's books, Come As You Are and Come Together, because sometimes it's people, it's not that they don't want sex, they don't want the sex they're having, or there's a whole other dance around that. And so understanding that and the analogy she uses around sort of brakes and acceleration and understanding what is happening at different life stages, whether it's parenting, busy times at work, going back to study, looking after aged parents, being aged, going through menopause, prostate care, like there'll be all of these things happening. The landscape changes. We can keep updating that knowledge of each other, whether it's emotionally, sexually, all of these things. So I think that one, I recommend those books to folk as well. And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they get in touch? What do you offer? Can you practice outside of California?
I do relationship coaching outside of California. So it's, you know, it's the same thing as therapy. It's a little bit different, I think, slightly. But my website is probably the best place to find me, therapywithandrea.love. It's got a ton of resources, a ton of different tools. I've got a course, like a little mini course coming out mid-August that's around the looping conversations and the looping fights that we get into in our marriages and how to break those loops and break those patterns, which, you know, I think ties into even, you know, all of this. It's just like it's very inexpensive and it's very useful, tangible tools to help people navigate those kind of conflicts that happen in every single marriage, you know, multiple times a month, sometimes multiple times a week.
Yes.
On what life stage they're in, right? They've just had children and their life's blowing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're having to expand.
I love that. We definitely looping conversations. Yep. Just the same thing. You can't believe you're still fighting about it.
Right.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for making the time to have a chat about this topic that I think sometimes can be kept quite secret. So I think it's been nice to spend a little bit of time and unpack it and give mm-hmm. people some ideas and tools of what to do next.
I think that's why that Coldplay, you know, exposure thing was so powerful, because it really brought it outward into the forefront so people could grapple with that.
And if you do see an increase in affairs with people's chatbots, hit me up, because we can do another episode on that. I'm dying to do a guest interview on that, because I've done a solo episode, but it is fascinating. And people buy lingerie for their chatbot. Like, it's, check it out. It's very new. So if you...
I have not, thankfully, had that yet.
When you do, let me know.
When I do. Marie, we have to talk about this.
But, you know, all jokes aside, it's happening for people, and it speaks to those same needs not being met and the turning away mm-hmm. from. And so, yeah, if people need the support, if something's missing, get some support, get some help, reach out to people, and we can help you work your way through it. Thank you for listening. To keep the conversation going, head on over to Instagram or LinkedIn and follow me. If you'd like to keep updated with episodes and other interesting things happening in mental health, join my weekly This Complex Life newsletter, where I'll share tools, tips, and insight. There's a link in the show notes. Got a question you want answered? Shoot me an email or a DM. I'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating and a review. It helps other people find the podcast.